credit union and those services for farm mm-hmm. workers. And then we had a co-op gas station okay. that was part of the service center, and we oversaw that. And then the service center is the one that bought the 40 acres and built the gas station out there and then built the clinic out there. And ultimately, you know, I mean, and so, I mean, these things were done hand in glove to further, to underpin, if you will, I guess, to strengthen the underpinnings of the efforts of the union. I mean, the union was getting its brains beat out in terms of striking, in terms of boycotting, in terms of, you know, trying to fend off strike breakers and all, you know, I mean, so that was their, that was they were the guerrilla operators, if you will. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the guerrilla force, I suppose. The service center was more the human services mm-hmm. sort of approach to farm workers. Yeah. I mean, for example, the service center began, I mean, was the beginnings of the, we had the death benefit program there, and we had the beginnings of the Robert F. Kennedy Farm Workers Medical Plan, was mm-hmm. spawned out of the service center, and then the Martin Luther King fund that came later, you know. I mean, but I mean, those were the humble beginnings. But yeah. but so I think that's, since Caesar and I, you know, for this 10-year period, 63 to 73, were like so much in sync. I mean, we were in daily. We worked together on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how to.
Yeah.
And I had many, many different assignments. I mean, many different.
Can we talk a little bit about some? I want to kind of run through, see
sure.
what you were doing that time period, and then come back and talk about some other issues that
sure.
kind of run through that. So.
Well, you mean some of the.
Yeah, you said
assignments.
Yeah, assignments. You were in charge of the service center. You.
Yeah, I was in charge of the service center. Founded the co-op. Some of the then the legal department was spawned out of the service center. So that's where I met Jerry Cohen. In fact, I was the one who recruited Jerry Cohen to come to work for the union. He was a first-year attorney at just out of law school at California Rural Legal Assistance in McFarland. I'm the one that found the 40 acres. I purchased the 40 acres. When I say I mean on behalf of, you know, the union
sure.
and service center. It wasn't
yeah.
me personally, of course.
Yeah.
And developed the 40 acres. I mean, I was in charge of that. I'm the one that found La Paz up at Tehachapi. I'm the one that made the arrangements for the purchase of that and found the Hollywood producer to put up the money.
There's a lot of different versions. We've done about 20 interviews with people. Julio Hernandez, Bill Chandler, Irene, you know, Ramos Chandler, Dora Saludado, Antonio Saludado, Roberto Bustos. I mean, just, you know, it's a range of people that have been there.
Sure.
And we hear different versions of how La Paz came about.
Well, I have my version.
Okay, well, that's what we'd like to hear.
You know,
I mean, they all sort of run together, but there's some you know, differences about. Well, let's hear your version.
My version, sure. Well, here's what happened.
Okay.
What I think.
Okay.
Caesar had talked for a long time about needing to have an international headquarters. In other words, he did not want to get tied into what would be the Delano local union,
mm-hmm.
because that would have its own internal politics, and also it would localize the union to, he thought, to too much of an extent in Delano. In other words, Delano meant grapes, mm-hmm. table grapes, etc. Fine, mm-hmm. but I mean, but his vision of a union and actually wanted to develop more than a union. did, I think. But he felt that he needed another headquarters that was not tied, would not be tied to any local. And at that headquarters, we could develop like a strike force, if you will, a boycott force, if you will, a fundraising force, if you will, or whatever we needed. I mean, we could, you know, and then strategically and tactically move about wherever we had to do, or wherever we had to go. But we'd have a base that was not tied to any one sector of the union. And Caesar's favorite place in the whole world was Santa Barbara. So I looked at places in Santa Barbara that might be available. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, we didn't have any money in those days, whatever, right. But we knew how to, raise money. I remember Caesar and I going over and looking at some places, but they were too posh. They were too, they were very expensive, and they just weren't in keeping with the mm-hmm. ambiance of the farm workers' movement. And he was very sensitive about that. And I remember one time, I even found a piece of property overlooking the ocean. He loved the ocean and overlooking the ocean, that was like on a hillside. And it was pretty reasonable, but no buildings. And then he had the idea, maybe we could develop this into a place where farm workers and their families, or ranch committees and their families, could come on for vacations. And in other words, they could have cabins, or they could have, camping, or that type of thing, Well, that didn't materialize. It's not that I'm getting you off on a tangent. I'm just saying that we went through this this process, and I knew he wanted to locate, if possible, in the Santa Barbara area, because he just had such
feeling. Are you working through at this time to not only a search for a location, but also developing what's going to take place there? Or
part of the discussion? It's part of the dreams. Mm-hmm. So you have to remember that the way Caesar worked was, things would be talked and massaged, and then they'd be dropped, and then they'd be talked and massaged again, and they'd come to a new sort of level of thinking, and then other things would be added, and other things, then it would drop, and then, ultimately, sort of consensus sort of built, even in his own mind. He didn't have a master plan. He was trying to figure out, as we went along, we all were, what the hell it is we were doing, what we wanted to do, why we wanted to do it. So somehow, what came across my desk through the service center is this sanitarium that became available through Kern County. They were going to auction it off. Mm-hmm. And so I went up and took a look at it. But they had a description of all the buildings and all the stuff and da-da-da. And I sort of checked it out and said to myself, it's got possibilities. The mountains, and it's removed, and da-da-da-da-da. And Caesar and I went up there, and others too, not just Caesar and I, but others went up there many times. And I think he sort of fell in love with it. And it had a lot of pluses that he was looking for, especially the fact that it had a lot of buildings. And, someone were in need of repair and this and that, but there was acreage, there was buildings, he was a visionary. He saw that, and also you have to realize, we had volunteers coming from all over the world, certainly, especially the United States and Canada, but, all over the world who were working on a volunteer basis with the farm workers in this movement, and housing was a problem, and feeding them was a problem, and just the sheer logistics. So here would be a place, for example, where we could accomplish some of those things. Now, then the question is, it was going to be up for auction, and we didn't want the union or the service center to be the ones, because in Kern County, it would be the death of the. We wouldn't have gotten it. That's what we felt anyway. Mm-hmm. You have to realize that we're probably more paranoid than maybe we needed be. I don't know. But it seemed very real at the time, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. I found Eddie Lewis, who was a Hollywood producer, and I went to meet him. I say I found him. I mean, I forget honestly what my connection to find him was. It could be that he called and wanted to do something for the farm workers or something. You know, I forget that part of it. But I remember going to his office, and I was just blown away by his office and, I mean, all these, I don't know, period furniture and antiques. And, oh, my God, it was very, you know. And he was a very energetic, high-strung, wired-up guy and nice guy. And so he brought his wife to La Paz, and Caesar and I and others, Gilbert Flores, I think, one time was with us. Anyway, we drove it all, da-da-da. Well, so Eddie agreed to put up the money. It was 10 years, maybe, something. We would pay my over a period of time. Now, I forget now whether the down payment he put up, he made as a donation, and we would pay him, basically we ended up paying him, there was a mortgage, and then we would pay the money, and then he would pay the mortgage. So I have a hunch that the initial money that he put up was probably a straight donation, and we paid off. And Frank Dennison, who was an attorney, is an attorney, and was sort of one of the volunteer attorneys at that time, he handled all the paperwork with respect to that, to the La Paz, numbers, the purchasing of it and all that. So anyway, Lewis either went in person or he sent somebody, I forget, and they went and they bid on it, da-da-da. And then, of course, later on it came out that really it was the farm workers, and that caused quite a to-do. Yeah. Now, I don't know. That's what happened as far as I know.
Okay. Typical stories talk about a donation or it was purchased by. So it sounds like that you know, what you've just run through has kind of been meshed in some different ways where parts being left out by some people rather than, you know, this process of the producer stepping in and then, in effect, you know, facilitating the purchase of.
Well, without Eddie Lewis, we wouldn't have had the money to do it. That's pure and simple.
Well, there are stories that some famous Hollywood person bought it and gave it. You know, these are the kinds of things you hear.
No, we certainly paid a great portion of it back.
Right.
Okay. Probably, as I say, I think that initial down payment was probably a donation.
Okay. Okay. So as a staff member, then we've you know, director of the service center, form co-op, legal department spin out, 40 acres purchased and developed, now La Paz, purchased and developed.
Yeah, and then Caesar would go off, you know. Now this, you know. So then we relocated to La Paz, you know, and all that. But Caesar would go off for months at a time, because of the boycott, touring the East and Canada and the Midwest, primarily the East, and fundraising and boycotting. I mean, you know, charging up troops. He'd be gone months at a time. I'm the one that ran the day-to-day operation of the union.
Okay.
Paid the bills.
Yeah.
You know, deposited the money, rent, whatever the bureaucracy of the union was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one that sort of administered on a day-to-day basis. Then when Caesar came back, he would take it back, and then he would do it.
So you were as it were, kind of a chief administrative officer to.
I made a lot of decisions. It's not like Caesar had no contact with me. We probably talked 2-3 times a day, even when he was on the road.
Right.
I mean, he wanted to know everything. He was the kind of person that thrived on feedback. And the reason is, I think, is because that's how he got his best ideas, was from feedback. I don't mean just from me, but from hundreds of people. And that's how he formed ideas and vision and consensus and, you know, programs. Anyway, so I made a lot of personnel decisions. I mean, you know, the routine kind of stuff. I mean, problems of staff, problems of da-da-da, what was going to be done at La Paz, what was going to be fixed, well, all that stuff. I mean, someone did it. I mean, someone had to do it. I was the person. I mean, I quite know how I got there, so to speak, but I mean, I was the person. And I don't know, honestly, that anyone like ever appointed me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's yeah. like Caesar said, well, Leroy, well, and then that was it. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah. And well, some of the people we have interviewed have quite frankly stated that when it came to things like that, that they didn't think there was someone better than you. That you really knew how to keep things organized and working.
Well,
I mean, I'll share that with you.
Well,
you
know, I mean, that's nice feedback. I just did it. I mean, as I say, Caesar and I were so close and so much on the same sheet of music, I guess, that same page of music, that, I mean, we almost talked in shorthand, you know. Mm-hmm.
Could we talk a little bit about then, if you're, you know, your same, it's like same page of music, you're talking in shorthand, what's some of the currents and thoughts that ran through that? Because, and specifically, you know, looking at things, for example, people will talk and people will write about Gandhian influences. People will write and talk about, you know, the encyclicals as an influence. And it's a very interesting coming together. You know, I mean, earlier in the interview, we talked about, you know, you mentioned the tension with Catholic and Protestant, and yet here's a case where with migrant ministry, you're dealing with Protestants. You come out of a very Catholic background, so
yes.
Can we talk about some of these things? I mean, was Gandhian philosophy really a part of the discussion, part of the debate, part of the perspective that infused what was going on, the encyclicals?
Yes, I would say so, but I think I can. I think I have some comments that I could help with. Caesar was tremendously influenced by what I think was called the California Mission Band, a group of priests, many of them spoke Spanish, who traveled throughout primarily the San Francisco diocese, giving retreats and workshops and stuff, and preaching social justice, and right out of the encyclicals, so to speak. In other words, not preaching the encyclicals, but I mean the themes. And Caesar really took to that and had very high regard for these priests who did this work, and he was tremendously influenced by them. And so I think it affirmed and reaffirmed in his own mind the role of the church with respect to the rights of workers and the rights of Mexicans, Mexican Americans, later Chicanos. In other words, what he was doing was had a religious overtone to it, and that it was worthwhile to dedicate your life to this kind of thing. It was very deep-seated belief of this type of social action and translating it into the real world and what he was doing. Now, at the same time, though, he was very open to other faiths and other philosophies. And Gandhi was certainly one. Now, when I first met Caesar, he had been in 28 elementary schools by the time he reached the 8th grade. I don't think he ever finished high school. His vocabulary was, I'd have to tell you, as an English teacher, was poor, was relatively elementary.
This is when you first met?
When I first met him. By 1968, after I began working with him, so the first two or three years, by the end of the third year, because of his reading, his vocabulary had developed it had quadrupled, it was tenfold. And he was a faithful reader of Gandhi. Mm-hmm. He read parts of the Bible. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give you the impression, because I don't think he was a daily Bible reader, mm-hmm. in the sense that a scripture scholar or study, you know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
But he read books, especially to do with the Kennedys, or you know.
We hear references to reading labor history.
Labor, yes. Well, yeah. About labor leaders.
Labor leaders, okay.
Yeah, not so much, you know, the more personalized.
Okay, I think. He would read about Gompers rather than the
right.
FFL.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's right. And he formed very strong opinions about unions and what he would not do as mm-hmm. a union leader. Yeah. In other words, the kinds yeah. of things that he would not do, mm-hmm. and that he would never settle for having a union that just was about wages and working conditions.
Okay.
That there was more to life than just
yeah.
that. So he was an avid reader and a disciplined reader, a faithful reader. In other words, I mean, he
did he set aside time
yes,
every day to read?
Yes,
or?
He did. Yeah. Yes, and he would get up very early in the morning. He kept prodigious hours. I mean, this man lived two lifetimes in one lifetime. I mean he was a very early riser. And he went to bed when he fell asleep, you know, which would be after midnight. I mean, he was a hard worker.
Yeah.
And so he was a very, obviously he was a very, very intelligent person. So when he was associating with people who were educated, mm-hmm. With attorneys, with doctors, with me, let's say, mm-hmm. a teacher, I mean, you know, I'm just using,
yeah.
I mean, he had a very sharp ear, so
yeah.
so he also soaked up vocabulary, soaked up ideas, he soaked up nuances of language by listening. He was a great listener, but he spoke with great authority. When he spoke with great authority, mm-hmm. and he always had the last word, always. There was never any question,
yeah.
regardless of whether the discussion went on for an hour or it went on for days or weeks, mm-hmm. and many of them did. When Caesar finally spoke, that was it. Then the discussion stopped, the debate was over, and it mm-hmm. was time to get to work, and we were all together. Probably part of the reason is we were so fucking exhausted. You know, I mean, you know,
yeah,
I mean, you just get to the point. Well, no, it's not like
yeah.
there was. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like that, that when the discussion started and Caesar said, this is the way it's going to be, and then we had to go through this horrible, agonizing weeks or days or whatever it was. And then at the end, Caesar said, well, I said this in the beginning and now. No, no.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a genuine give and take.
There was a process.
There was a process. Mm-hmm. It was a process. And Caesar loved to hear people give forth. And he listened. It doesn't mean he agreed.
Yeah.
Sometimes he would argue and get very annoyed.
He engaged in that process.
Engaged.
He
oh,
was
absolutely.
Not just an observer
no,
who
no,
gave
no.
a summary.
No, he wasn't. He didn't. He
yeah.
didn't just sit back and then put it all together.
Yeah.
And, yeah. No, 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 no. No, he was a participant. But Caesar was. I mean, I've said this a dozen times, but it's very, very true. He was just a very keen listener,
mm-hmm.
and so. And so you felt when you were talking with him that you had his undivided attention,
mm-hmm.
and you did.
Yeah.
He would not be rushed. He wouldn't be distracted. He took time with people. I mean, probably too much time. I mean, you know, but that's the way
mm-hmm.
he was. I mean, you know, he was a terrible public speaker. Always was. I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Never felt comfortable, but with a person or a small group or whatever, mm-hmm. he could hold forth eloquently
mm-hmm.
for hours. I don't mean just doing all the talking,
right.
but
yeah.
but engaged.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always organizing you. Always, always organizing you. That was his.
Mm-hmm.
That was his life.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the, one of the elements, influences is the Industrial Areas Foundation because of the training with the CSO and then
mm-hmm.
and subsequent, you know, contacts with it. Mm-hmm. Does that continue to be an element, or is it something that was in an earlier part of the process was an element?
Well, that's interesting. I don't think. I don't think Saul Alinsky had much use for Caesar. Now, I didn't know Saul Alinsky, so I'm. But I don't think. I knew Caesar very well, and I think. I don't think Caesar had much regard for Saul Alinsky either. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not. I don't.
So the differences are more than just. There's references to differences on the utility and usefulness of house meetings as organizing tool, but so the differences go.
Oh yeah, there's nothing to do with that.
That's no. Just superficial.
That's right. No. It's not that he didn't think that the tactics or the method or the process was excellent. He thought it probably was, especially you mentioned house meetings. But no. I think there's more to. I don't know. I don't know Saul Alinsky, so it's not fair for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, so I'll be careful. I'll try to be careful. Well, but mm-hmm. I do know Caesar. Caesar mm-hmm. lived what he preached. This man lived a life of voluntary poverty. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think you can take a look at community organizers or union leaders in this country and say that they lived a life of voluntary poverty and that they gave mm-hmm. of themselves at that level. You know, I mean, this man did not own anything. I mean, he was poorer than, than a Franciscan monk. I mean, he didn't own anything, basically. And he didn't put on airs, and he didn't dress to suit the occasion. And he was just him. He was himself, and he considered himself a person of the people, and that they were suffering, and that to empower them, if you will, he had to show that he was willing to live at a level that they could see that he didn't have to live at, but he chose to live at that level. They knew that he could have had a high government-appointed position in the Kennedy administration or in the Johnson administration. Yeah. I mean, he could have had, they knew that, but he chose not to have those things. Now, what I think Caesar. Caesar's belief in Fred Ross Sr. as the premier organizer. I mean, there is no question in my mind the high regard that he held with Fred Ross Sr. And Fred Ross Sr. in the beginning days was not involved with the union. I don't know why or why not. I'm sure he had other mm-hmm. jobs. I don't know. But there came a point when he could be involved, and Caesar wanted him involved, and Caesar paid, because I'm the one that paid, mm-hmm. paid to have Fred Ross involved. Now, I don't mean overpaid. I just mean that Fred Ross Sr. was the exception in Caesar's mind in terms of people being paid, which he wanted to have Fred. Well, Fred didn't run the... Fred was not... He didn't organize for the whole union, but he had areas of responsibility, the DiGiorgio campaign, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, Caesar approved of Fred's methods in the sense of his charts and his detail and his daily meetings, twice a day, morning and evening, and house meetings and the discipline that he expected of the organizers that were assigned to him, and we had dozens of volunteers, you know. Now, so that I can attest to, and that he felt that Fred was effective. Fred Sr. was a very difficult person to work for. And I dare say there, while he was tremendously effective, many people could not work for him because of his rigidity in terms of the way it had to be done. And you know, that works both ways. I mean, a lot is accomplished. But it's my way or no way. Mm-hmm. And that works. That works and it doesn't work.
Yeah. You can accomplish certain goals, but yeah. there may be costs.
That's right. Yeah. Always costs. Oh, yeah. Always costs, yeah. But that wasn't Fred's problem. Fred's problem was, hey, this you want me? This is what I do. This is how I do it. Take it or leave it. No hard feelings.
Yeah.
And Caesar took it. And I mean, he wanted that and needed that for certain certain kinds of campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Like the Jumara was a particularly difficult one.
Yes. The one I'm thinking was DiGiorgio.
DiGiorgio?
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure the Jumara campaign was...
Because I remember, I remember Junior out there in the press and...
Well, Fred Ross Jr. was...
No, I mean Junior Jumara.
Oh, Junior Jumara. Oh, yes. But see, one of the life and death crossroads of the Union was the DiGiorgio
strike. Yeah.
The election. And that's what Fred Ross ran, was the election.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, who was going to vote? Who was going to vote for the Union? Who was going to vote against the Union? I mean, you know, and all of that organizing that went around that. I mean, it was a major... If the Union had lost that election, it could have publicly doomed the Union in the eyes of the public. Well, here's where farm workers had a chance to vote, and my God, they didn't even vote for the Union, right? I mean, you know, it would have been... So,
do you remember how the idea of getting the ALRB to allow the Union to bring back workers that had worked there in the past, how that arose, and who managed that process with the board?
No, I don't know that specifically. I just know that in that first summer of the ALRB, that first summer of elections, there were more than 40,000 farm workers that voted in that series of elections, you know, many, many elections. I don't know the nuances of what you're talking about there. That's probably because the general counsel's office for the ALRB probably handled that aspect of it. In other words, who was eligible to vote, who wasn't eligible to vote, and